This is Jim Inkster coming today on Talk Louisiana. We'll visit with Robert Travis Scott, president of the Public Affairs Research Council, former Capitol Bureau chief for the Times-Picayune. He'll comment on the fiscal cliff that awaits Governor John Bel Edwards and the legislature as Louisiana faces a projected $1.5 billion deficit come July of next year. Also, the latest on Hurricane Harvey, now a tropical depression that continues to wreak havoc. Doug Shane, who is the primary pollster for President Clinton, will discuss the friction in American politics from the perspective of a conservative Democrat. His book is America in the Age of Trump. And Carol Friedland, the LSU Bert Turner Department of Construction Management Associate Professor, will talk about information that is vital for homeowners living in flood-prone areas. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Coming later in the show, we'll visit with the renowned pollster, Doug Schoen. He was Bill Clinton's pollster for many years, and he'll talk about what's going on in American politics. His book is America in the Age of Trump, Opportunities and Oppositions in an Unsettled World. Also, Carol Friedland, the LSU Bert Turner Department of Construction Management Associate Professor on information for homeowners in flood areas. And we, as a city where we're located, for the most part, dodged a really bad situation with Hurricane Harvey, but our friends in Texas and in southwest Louisiana have a different story to tell. And with us to begin is Robert Travis Scott, who for the last 6 years has been head of the Public Affairs Research Council, but for 8 years was the Capitol Bureau Chief for the Times-Picayune. Good morning, Robert Scott.
Good morning. I think I might hang around, too, to listen to the pollster.
There you go.
It's a good show, Jim.
Well, thank you. But we start with a man who knows this state well, and before we get to dollars and cents, you covered a few hurricanes, and you live in Baton Rouge. I remember you were down the street from me in 2008 when Gustav came, and of course you covered Katrina. Those are experiences we'll never forget.
It's so true. I lived in New Orleans for a number of years when you were just constantly watching the hurricanes and the cone maps during this part of the year. And then I moved up here to Baton Rouge, and you had to continue to do that for Katrina and for Rita. I was working out of the command post for the Times-Picayune, the command post for the State Emergency Center. And that's where the governor and his team would get together with all the first responders, emergency management folks. And I tell you, it was quite an experience to, you know, be on those front lines and see exactly what they were dealing with from the command center.
877-217-5757 is your number, and the email is talk@talklouisiana.org. Hurricane Harvey has left major devastation in Texas, but there's another hurricane called Irma out in the Atlantic that could take aim in the U.S. within the next week or so. Irma became a hurricane early yesterday, and by last night it was upgraded to a major hurricane, which requires sustained winds greater than 110 miles per hour. Given the early stages, weather models are not in total agreement over Irma's likely path or potential power, but all hurricane-prone areas from the Gulf of Mexico to the eastern seaboard could be in its target. What do you think of this one?
And that's right. All my Twitter feed, everybody I've been talking to and since yesterday evening, this is what everybody's thinking about and now worried about. I remember after Katrina and how horrible that was, hardly anybody could believe there was yet another major hurricane coming into the Gulf when Rita started pouring in. And the anxiety level was just really raised. And I know for the people in Texas, you know, the idea of another big, you know, major hurricane coming their way is really scary. But right now we don't know where it's going to go.
Robert Travis Scott is the voice you're hearing, and the number is 877-217-5757, locally 297-5633, and email us at talk@talklouisiana.org. Robert has experience both as a journalist and now as a watchdog of government, and right now the state is facing what could be a hurricane of sorts come July 1st of next year. This fiscal cliff is one of those things, like it's like a hurricane way, way, way out right now. But when you look at it, July 1st, according to my math, is exactly 10 months from today. So
that's right.
Something has to be done or we'll be in a world of hurt. as a state.
Well, that's right. And there's a couple of cliffs when we talk about the cliff. There's the cliff because there are temporary taxes on the books, and those are going to roll off. And that's in particular the extra penny, the extra 1% state sales tax, where we went from 4% to 5%. They also broadened the base on that tax. They applied it to a few more things than they apply the normal sales tax to. So when that goes off the books, in addition to a few other things that are on the books on a temporary way, we're going to have well more than $1 billion in revenue that will disappear unless something is done. For example, just continuing that temporary tax, making it temporary another couple more years. And then you have the other cliff, which is what a lot of people talk about, which is not only the amount of revenue that will be short, but if you take into account spending increases that might be expected on the state budget, your budget gap, your budget cliff gets even bigger if you count it that way. I think we've been mostly concerned about that first cliff and trying to address it.
877-217-5757 as we move along this morning. Robert Travis Scott is the leadoff guest, and he is a guy who's a graduate of the University of South Carolina but came to Louisiana and stayed. And while he was working with the Picayune, lived here in Baton Rouge as the Capitol Bureau Chief. In the old days, Baton Rouge wasn't expected to feel the brunt of these hurricanes. It always happened to some extent, but for the most part, we didn't get the action that other parts of the state did located on the coast. That's all changed. Gustav proved that. And for those who lived through Gustav and the flood of 2016, Robert, we know that in Baton Rouge, we can definitely have significant weather events.
You really can, and I knew this back when Hugo hit, back in, I think it was 89, when it hit the South Carolina coast, which is where I had been living, you know, previously. And it just washed, it just went hundreds of miles inland, wreaking a lot of havoc. Mm-hmm. And so when Gustav was headed our way, I remember telling people, this is going to be big in Baton Rouge. And everyone was, oh, we'll handle it. So we ended up, it was just as bad as I had had feared. And the whole town shut down for a couple of weeks.
In the last few days, we've talked about how Louisiana has not grown in the way that Texas has. And when you compare Baton Rouge and Houston, New Orleans and Houston, New Orleans was a larger city than was Houston in 1940. In 1950, Houston was the 14th largest city. New Orleans was the 16th in the United States. And here we are, 67 years later since 1950. And New Orleans is a city that's lost 100,000 people. It's gone from I've lost a couple of 100,000. 384,000. It was about 600,000 in 1950. And in Houston has gone from about 400,000 people to a city population of 2.3 million and a metro area of 6.6 million. What happened to cause
so much that? So much has happened. You know, the New Orleans airport, I believe right after World War II, was, I think, the second busiest airport in the United States, and it had a lot of Latin American connections that it didn't have. And it also, as a port city, it was a really premier spot. But we've seen Houston, Galveston, that whole area grow in the oil and chemical business and also grow in the services around that, grow as a port, grow in technology. Houston is a really diverse city, and I think we've seen this watching all of the coverage of the floods from Harvey, is that there's an enormous variety of people who have moved into the area over time, and people seeing it as a place where they would have a lot of opportunity.
Well, Houston has grown exponentially, and Louisiana as a state has not grown, and New Orleans has actually lost people. There have to be some factors to have caused that, Robert. I know
Texas,
it's a difficult question, but...
Yeah, Texas, in the census... In the census of 2000 versus 2010, the Texas population grew by more than the entire population of Louisiana. And, you know, a lot of this has to do with not just states, but with communities and cities. We focus a lot on state policy. We focus a lot on state economic development. And certainly that's an appropriate thing to do. But when you look around the country, and when you look at Texas in particular, it's these cities, these metro centers that have really been the economic drivers the incredible story of Austin and what's happened there, Houston and all the surrounding area, Dallas, Fort Worth, San Antonio. This is where so much of the growth has taken place, and people have been, really been drawn there. The population has really increased, and industry has really grown.
Well, we have natural resources that rival Texas. Why haven't we grown in the same way?
This is the question that everyone wrestles with in Louisiana. Why aren't we more like Texas? And some people point to tax system and say that ours is not as favorable. And we could have a discussion about the differences there. You have in Texas a system that relies more on local governments and local tax revenues to sort of drive what's going on in the schools and what's driving what's going on in the economic development sphere and in the infrastructure sphere more than you have in Louisiana. And that's one of the structural differences that you see. And a lot of people point to that and think that might be part of the key. But, you know, I think a lot of it, too, is just as an enormous amount of wealth. In Texas that has moved in there, and there is an enormous amount of oil and gas and chemical industry that has helped push all that along, and wealth leads to more wealth. And so I think that is really probably the underlying reason for it.
Well, when we return, we'll talk with Robert Travis Scott about whether politics has also affected the growth in Texas and the lack of growth in Louisiana. 877-217-5757 is your number. Pollster Doug Schoen is coming later, and we'll be back after this quick timeout on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us. Allie Baltazar is producing. Hope you're getting ready for a good holiday, and the LSU Fighting Tigers will be in New Orleans tomorrow, playing in the Louisiana Superdome instead of the NRG Stadium in Houston. That game had to be moved with BYU, the season opener for Ed Orgeron's troops, because of Hurricane Harvey. 877-217-5757. The political differences between Texas and Louisiana, have they contributed to the growth that has been exponential in Texas and has been stagnant in Louisiana over the last half century?
Well, I think if you ask the average person, you know, they'd probably tell you that's got to be the case. But, you know, Texas has its own political issues. I mean, in terms of their divisiveness, there's a lot of that that's been going on between Republicans and Democrats for many years. They have their fights as well as we do. I wouldn't want to say that, you know, their state and their legislature is, you know, a harmonious place and ours is not. I don't think that would be an accurate comparison. In terms of, you know, you have to go back and just look at what drives wealth, what drives people to come into your state, what drives people decide to make investments in your state. And a lot of the structure we have in terms of incentives are really not bad, you know, for making those things happen. So then you narrow down to why isn't it happening more? Is there a culture here in Louisiana that when other people come in and try to think about trying to do business here, that they don't like the culture? They love the culture of the food. They love the culture of the party. But do they like the political mm-hmm. culture and the image, not necessarily reality, that it's just going to be a more difficult culture to operate in, both as a regulatory matter and as a corruption matter. And that's right. Something that you really takes a generation, I think, to really grow out of.
I remember your former colleague at the Picayune, Jack Wardlaw, writing many years ago that Walt Disney came to Louisiana in the early 1970s, actually late 60s, and he was contemplating putting what became Disney World in St. Tammany Parish, and he was... according to the legend, he was not pleased with the politics and moved to Florida. Imagine if we'd had Disney World, but it didn't work out quite the way it should have or could have. Mike in New Orleans. Mike, good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana with Robert Travis Scott.
Good morning. Yeah, you guys, I was hoping I could make just one comment about the discussion that I'm listening to on my drive from New Orleans to Baton Rouge. I'm a born and raised New Orleanian, and your characterization of the of what's hobbling the region, the New Orleans, maybe Baton Rouge, Southern Louisiana economy is on point. But I want to make a broader point. I'm not sure that your discussion is fair in that you shape it up to sound like the objective for our area is to become a Houston or to become an Atlanta type exponential growth trajectory. I, as a New Orleanian, with all of its problems, with all of its slow growth, for one, thank God we haven't become a Houston or in Atlanta. Jack Kerouac said something. He said there are three great cities in this country. There's New York, there's New Orleans, and there's San Francisco. Everything else is Cleveland.
But didn't he write that in about 1950, Mike?
Yeah, he did. But my point is that the cultural richness and uniqueness of the city where I grew up, I thank God, hasn't been destroyed by the milk. Well, I don't know how to describe it.
Well, let's let Robert comment, and you stay on the line, Mike.
But, Mike, it's a great point, and I share your love for New Orleans, and I also share your sentiment that, you know, I don't want it to become like a lot of other places, and I would agree with that. Now, I remember I went with a New Orleans chamber, GNO type group on a visit to Austin some years ago, back in, I think, the late 1990s, around 2000 or so. And I can tell you there was a lot of things that business and leadership community in New Orleans wanted to see us do that Austin was doing, in terms of airport enhancements, in terms of being a place for more creative arts, to actually exploit some of the great things that New Orleans has offered and try to make it, you know, even better. The part of the problem is that there's so many things in New Orleans that have not been just sustaining or growing. They've been falling back. And as much as I love, and I moved to New Orleans in 1996. I'm in love with New Orleans. I really am. But since then, boy, the city's lost a lot of industry jobs, a lot of oil and gas jobs, and you have to find ways to make that up over time. And even if you're not becoming a huge growth city, you need to stay healthy and you need to stay safe. And that's things
totally
that
agree.
New Orleans
I
is
think
having
that,
trouble with.
The strain is going to continue to be applied to New Orleans in the coming years because of what climate change is going to render in the coming decades. It's going to put that stress more on it. It's a changing city. My point to you all, and thank you for taking my call, was simply to point out that there's a yin and yang to this discussion about just how great, how large, and how successful, you're right, we want to become. So,
all right.
It's a great point, Mike. I'm glad you made that. Of course, Baton Rouge has really been coming from a somewhat different orientation. Baton Rouge has, for a long time, been seen as the great potential for a big business growth area, and not just the city, but the region itself. And that's what we really talk about nowadays. When we talk about economic development, you're really talking about metro areas, regional growth. That's where the focus is. But I thought a great point by Mike.
Well, the lack of growth has caused us to lose two congressional seats in the last 20 years. And that is a factor when you think about it, Robert Travis Scott. The power that we used to have on Capitol Hill has been diminished in a huge way, and it has a lot to do with what the state gets as far as benefits from the federal government. And we've got to keep growing at the rate of the country, or we'll continue to lose congressional seats. our state used to be much bigger than the state where you went to school, South Carolina. South Carolina is now a larger state than Louisiana.
Yeah,
has one more electoral vote, one more U.S. House member.
That's right. And I watched that dynamic go on. And I was living in South Carolina for a number of years and saw the growth that was going on there and covered it as a business editor and columnist. And they were very outward oriented. They were very economic development oriented and trying to, they had a dying textile industry, or at least one that was fading away. They needed to replace it. And they went worldwide and brought investments from all over the world and jobs from all over the world to help sustain.
Well, Robert Travis Scott, it is always a pleasure to talk with you. And for those unaware, you've had a bit of a challenge yourself. You've come back from a pretty good car accident.
Oh no, I'm fine, and nothing compared to the awful accident you had.
Well, that's like comparing Texas and Louisiana.
That's right.
But at the same time, I know it was a close call, and we're glad you're okay. And it's good that you're still here. How has the transition been from your old job as a tough, hard-nosed reporter to the one that you have now as a guy who works more with a feather duster than a pen? What's it like as a watchdog?
Well, the nicest part of it is I still get to be on the Jim Inkster show in both jobs. So that.
Well, you do it well, and we're glad you're still in the game. And Robert Travis Scott, we hope Hurricane Irma does not cause more devastation.
Amen.
This would be a horrible event, and we'll wait and see. But we're not even to the halfway mark of the hurricane season. So
let's hope it goes north and dissolves like an Alka-Seltzer in the Atlantic.
Well, we'll be back with more. Now the news on 89.3 WRKF with Karen Henderson. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us. 877-217-5757 is your number for Talk Louisiana, locally in the Baton Rouge area, 297-5633. And you can send us an email, talk@talklouisiana.org. We're visiting now with noted pollster Doug Schoen. For many years, he's been at the forefront of American politics and is recognized as one of the best in his business, one of the most influential Democratic campaign consultants for over 30 years, with clients including Michael Bloomberg, Evan Bayh, Bill Clinton, and corporate clients like AOL, Time Warner, Procter & Gamble, and AT&T. His latest work is America in the Age of Trump, Opportunities and Oppositions in an Unsettled World. Good morning, Doug Schoen.
Good morning, and pleased to be here.
Well, nice to talk with you. Well, our president's now on day 225. It was 32 weeks ago today that he took the oath of office. It's been quite a ride.
It sure has, and it's a ride that appears to show no signs of slowing down.
Well, you're often described as a moderate to conservative Democrat, so I think that you're a fair arbiter when it comes to analyzing this president. What can he do to change the inertia right now that doesn't
Sure.
seem to be working for him?
Well, look, I think some of the policies, and I say this as a Democrat, some, and we say this in America in the Age of Trump, are working. And I think that they are mostly reasonable policies, even if they be ones that might disagree with. Where the problem is the rhetoric, the tweets, the volatility. Now, he's calmed it down lately since General Kelly's been there. But you know what? I just think if we focused on trying to achieve results, perhaps more bipartisanship, President Trump would do better, and the people of the United States would be better served.
877-217-5757 for Doug Schoen, who worked with President Clinton. And when we compare the 42nd president with the 45th, is it like comparing apples and oranges, or do you see some similarities between what President Clinton faced when he became the leader of the free world 25 years ago and what Donald Trump is facing right now?
Yeah, I think that the difference is we had to figure out how to confront a Republican Congress, and Donald Trump's trying to figure out how to confront a Republican Congress. Now, it is a little bit of a joke, I appreciate that, but on the other hand, Donald Trump is as much an independent as he is a Republican, and I guess he's probably the first Republican I've seen to attack his base as aggressively he is. He is attack people like Mitch McConnell and Senator Flake from Arizona, Senator McCain. You know, it's an amazing set of circumstances. Well, Senator Heller.
Mm-hmm. In America in the Age of Trump, Doug Schoen offers an assessment of a nation in turmoil, looking beneath the well-known problems to identify underlying yet poorly understood causes. What are some of the things beyond the surface that we're not accenting that perhaps we should?
Sure. A lack of trust in our system, a sense that our election and electoral system is out of control, is, sort of rigged by special interests. The fact that politicians tend to be more responsive to their party leaders frequently than to their constituents, and that we have a news media, to be fair to the president, that frequently is so biased that they, it's not even so much to me fake news, it's that their perspectives are so unreasonable and unfair, we don't get an honest assessment.
Well, yesterday, for example, the president offered, or more than offered, he said he would contribute $1 million to flood relief. And in most cases, if a president did that, it would be met with a lot of praise. But in Donald Trump's case, it was met with skepticism because he's, of course, he said he would release his tax returns. He says a lot of things. Does he have to start following through on some of the things he says?
Yeah, he does. And... he does. And look, I take him at his word. If the President of the United States, with the full authority of his office, says he's going to give $1 million, I have to believe him, though in the past there have been credibility issues, and I'm aware of that, too. So I guess what I would say is please let this be the start of an effort to bring the country together and to heal. And if that happens, that money will be very well spent.
Now, both Bill Clinton and Donald Trump addressed health care, and in Bill Clinton's case, he gave up the ghost, but it probably cost Democrats dearly in 1994 in the midterm elections. If President Trump's unable to deliver health care reform or the repeal and replacement of Obamacare, will he pay a political price?
Oh, I think so. I think in the 18 elections, if the Republicans with control of the House and the Senate are unable to get anything through, he will pay a price as Bill Clinton did in 1994. I think that's another absolutely good analogy. And that's one of the reasons why I think he needs to, on things like health care, do not repeal and replace, which he's not going to get through, but fixes on Obamacare, which will keep it affordable, will keep access broadened, and make sure that there is competition in the system.
Doug, as far as the budget, President Clinton, I recall in 1993, got a budget plan through Congress with no votes to spare in both the House and the Senate. Both chambers barely passed his measure, which revitalized the American economy. President Trump faced this with health care, with John McCain casting the deciding vote that kept it from going the extra distance. At least moving to another level. What does the president have to do to make sure he gets a majority on his initiatives?
Well, the president needs to lower his voice. He needs to try to reach out to Democrats and moderate Republicans and not try to govern as if it's his way or the highway and let the Freedom Caucus have a veto over what he does. That's just self-defeating.
And as far as restoring confidence in the American system, right now it appears that many Americans are really upset with what's going on, and perhaps that led to the president's election, but now he's governing. What can he do to restore confidence?
Try to bring the country together. Soothing, healing rhetoric, as he did in a couple of his speeches last week, last Monday and Wednesday. Not the campaign rallies we saw in Phoenix. I think we need a healing, inclusive president who brings the Democrats in, who seeks to unite the country now that we're going through a national crisis, an emergency because of Harvey. I think if he does all that, we've got a chance.
What about the investigation from Robert Mueller? This is one that appears to have some legs and some relevance. Is this going to be damaging and perhaps more than damaging to the president?
I think it could be. I think we have to stay tuned. There have been no explicit findings yet of collusion. On the other hand, some of the evidence about General Flynn and Paul Manafort that's been developed is, at the very least, troubling.
And it keeps the president certainly preoccupied. Distracted.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. And I would also urge him to focus on the job at hand rather than attacking Mueller or trying to game the system.
This bromance, if you will, that he's had with Vladimir Putin, do you find this curious?
Yeah, I do. I do. I worry about it, especially when we learned that they were negotiating in December and January of 2015 and 2016 to build Trump Tower in Moscow. It is all very troubling, yes.
So at the very least, when Robert Mueller issues his report, the president is going to have to answer some questions. Based on his reactions when he's under siege, it would seem that he will react with great hostility. Is that dangerous as far as him getting anything accomplished that he desires?
Well, it is. First, we have to see if any charges are brought against anybody else other than the president. That's number one. Number two, what's in the report, how the president reacts, how the Democrats react, and whether it impacts on legislation. So all true.
And with the threat from North Korea still percolating and President Trump saying that North Korea, if it keeps this up, will be met with fire and fury, does that appease the fears of the people of America who, in some cases, maybe for good reason, fear the worst?
Well, I think it scares people. And I think you saw yesterday that the last couple of days that the rhetoric from the president, the rhetoric from the Secretary of Defense, Jim Mattis, have been very different. Maybe they're playing good cop, bad cop, but Trump is hawkish. Mattis is much more focused on negotiations and diplomacy. I mean, I hope we can avoid any conflict, but, you know, I woke up to Vladimir Putin said we're on the risk of a world war. Trump says we're on the risk of a world war, and at a certain point in time, these things become self-fulfilling prophecies.
In your book, America in the Age of Trump, you also write about race relations. That is an issue that has come to full bloom of late and not in a good way.
That's true. I mean, I blame both Trump and Obama. I think Obama missed a historic opportunity to bring the country together. I think Trump, given some of the rhetoric on Charlottesville, has further polarized the divided country. And you know, I'm not one to say, well, it was Obama's fault or Trump's fault. It's everybody's fault. We're not lowering our voices. We're not trying to come together. And the net loser, I dare say, are the American people.
Well, the president, according to most observers, now you've said the media are not being fair to the president. Were they fair to him when they criticized him for the way he spoke after the Charlottesville debacle?
Yeah, I think they were fair. I think they beat up on him a lot. And I'd like to say we can all do better and hopefully we'll move past it.
Well, we'll spend just a couple more minutes. If you'd like to pose a question, email us at talk@talklouisiana.org for Doug Schoen. Your number is 877-217-5757. We're back in 2 minutes with more from one of the top political consultants in the world, Doug Schoen. His book is America in the Age of Trump. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us. Ali Baltazar producing. The show is Talk Louisiana. And in just a moment, we're going to hear from Carol Friedland from LSU about what's going on with the rebuilding efforts regarding these massive natural disasters that we've had to deal with, and one this week, of course, which has affected our neighbors in Texas in a profound way. But we're wrapping it up with Doug Schoen. His book is America in the Age of Trump. Doug, one of the most influential Democratic campaign consultants in the country, and you started doing this when you were in high school, didn't you, Doug?
I did, yeah, and haven't regretted it at all. It's a great and glorious game with real-world, not only implications, but direct impact on the lives we lead. And it seems we've become more immediate and more urgent in our politics as time has gone on. And I think that's a good thing, provided, and a big proviso, we do what we said in America in the Age of Trump, try to bring the country together, find solutions that find common ground. So hopefully we can all cooperate and achieve profound and significant results.
Since you're a numbers man, a listener, Tracy in Baton Rouge, asks what you think the odds are that President Trump will finish out his term.
I think they're very high that he'll finish out his term. You know, it takes a two-thirds vote to, I guess, impeach, and we're not there yet. We're not even close to that.
Well, we thank you for joining us. It's a pleasure, it's America in the Age of Trump from Doug Schoen. Thank you, Doug. We're joined now in studio by Carol Friedland. She is the LSU Burt S. Turner Department of Construction Management Associate Professor, 8 years at the Old War School, and she did her graduate work at LSU after getting her undergraduate degree from the University of Wyoming, and she is an expert on coming back from natural disasters, and we've had a little bit of that to do of late.
We sure have, Jim. Thanks for having me.
Well, what are some of the ways that people can get ready, if there is any such way, when they're living in flood-prone areas?
I think the biggest issue is being prepared well in advance. As the flood is coming, it's a little too late to think about if your building is resilient enough for floods. And a lot of this is done through elevation, through building codes, and really elevating your building higher than the base flood elevation.
Do the buildings in Louisiana meet the satisfactory codes?
The buildings are built to the building code. There's been a lot of change at the national level with regard to building codes for floods. There's a national standards committee, which I sit on, which is the Flood-Resistant Design and Construction Committee of the American Society of Civil Engineers. And in the 2014 standard, they recommended adding one extra foot of elevation, which the Louisiana Code Council last November rejected. So Governor Edwards issued that executive order putting a stop to changing the building code. So we've got to see what's going to happen with that.
Well, when a structure faces damage from a storm, and in Texas, as mentioned, it has been profound. If you look at the Advocate this morning, the front page is filled with numbers about those who have lost their homes as a result of Hurricane Harvey. But when this happens, if it's a flood event, is that different than when it's a wind event?
It sure is. The building responds in different ways. One of the issues in terms of especially with codes is we design and build our buildings to a 700-year wind level. So we've got less than a 0.02 chance of any damage really being done from a wind event. So it has to be a really severe wind event. But yet we design our buildings for flood, that there's a 1% chance that they would flood in any year. So that results in a 26% chance over the life of a mortgage or over the life of the building. The buildings that are built to the 100-year flood have a 50% chance of flooding. So in that life, either you or your neighbor will flood.
Carol Friedland is our guest. She's a professor of construction management at LSU, the Burt S. Turner Construction Management Professor. And she has been there for long enough to have been through a few of these events. You were here when, when Hurricane Gustav came through. And in Baton Rouge, we've had a lot to deal with from that and the years since, and most notably last year with the flood. Were people ready for this kind of an event in our community?
I think that there's a false sense of security about especially our flood resilience. People buy homes, developers build homes, and in that building stock, we're really not as resilient to floods as we could be and as the nation is changing. So I think really being aware that our flood risk in Louisiana is a bit higher than other states and trying to take a more proactive approach to the building that you live and work in.
What about sustainable construction being used in other states is practical in Louisiana, things we can learn?
A lot of the sustainability principles focus more on using low-energy materials. In some ways, sustainable principles are at odds with hazard-resistant principles, right? Because for hazard resistance, you would want a more robust foundation. But overall, over time, if you're able to resist the floods, you're not only hazard-resistant, but also sustainable as well.
And no area, even in the same city, is the same. Some areas are more vulnerable than others. And last year, people found out in the hard way that in many cases they were told they were not in flood zones, but yet they flooded. So what kind of precaution should be made no matter where you are in a given community that is susceptible to this kind of an event?
That's correct, Jim, and I think that's a source of confusion for many people. If you look at a flood map or you look and see if you need flood insurance, you're either told you're in or out. So you either face a flood hazard or you don't, but that's just really not true. If the 120-year flood comes, for example, and your elevation of the building is at that level, you will flood. Knowing your risk, one of the ways you can do that is go to the LSU Ag Center flood map portal. You can type in Louisiana flood maps in your internet browser, and you can look at the flood maps for anywhere in Louisiana, and that's a great resource that we have. You can see how close you are to the line. If you go, there's more detailed maps that show some mapped 500-year floods, but that Ag Center portal is a great resource for everybody.
877-217-5757 in our remaining time with Carol Friedland, who is a professor of construction management at LSU, and she is commenting on some of the things we can do to perhaps get ready. And if we have a problem, to not have the intense issues that are ongoing. Some of these people from the flood of last year, Carol, as you know, they're still facing problems and big challenges.
It's a horrible situation. And I think something that we really need to consider, when you do flood, now you've got to clean, gut, mold remediation, rebuild. It's a long process. It affects the quality of life. If it happens to a big business, it can put people out of work. So as the state of Louisiana, I think we need to really take a hard look at this economically and decide what our citizens can bear in terms of that type of disruption in their lives, because that was not just a once-in-a-lifetime event. If Hurricane Harvey were 200 or 300 miles to the east, what would we be facing right now?
And a listener notes that we have a lot of greenery in Baton Rouge and in Louisiana, and no matter how strong your house is, if you've got some big trees around it, that's a mismatch in a storm, isn't it?
That's absolutely true. So those trees provide us a lot of shade. They're attractive. We like living with them. Hazard-resistant construction principles really tell you if you live within the fall radius of a tree, that you should cut it down. Certainly, you should have an arborist come out and look at it, make sure that it's safe to be in your yard. But that does cause a lot of damage for homes, especially here in Baton Rouge.
Well, we take pride in those trees, but they can be dangerous at times like these.
Sometimes we have to decide if we want the tree or our house.
Well, I think the choice would be pretty easy, but quite often, it's just like with flood insurance. Jim Donilon, the commissioner of insurance, has said that, you know, when something like this happens, people want to go out and buy flood insurance and get covered right now. Well, it doesn't work that way. We have to take precautions. Too often are we complacent?
I think that's true. And I also think, you know, to look at flood insurance doesn't solve the problem. In fact, the National Flood Insurance Program is $25 billion in debt. So as a nation, I think we can see that we have a flooding problem. And in the state of Louisiana, I think we need to ask ourselves, are we happy with our current performance of buildings in these flood events? If we are, that's great. Let's talk about LSU football.
Uh-huh.
If we're not happy, then, you know, we really need to look at what we're doing and make changes and not just assign financial responsibility through insurance, because it's hurting the people of our state.
Well, and in the city of Houston, for example, this flood may rival other floods, but now, in the last half century, the city has grown four or five times. So you have four or five times the number of people who are vulnerable. So naturally, the numbers are going to be greater now than they were in 1950 or 1960.
That's correct. And I read an estimate in USA Today that maybe 80% of Harvey flood victims don't have insurance. So that financial security blanket wouldn't be there for those people. I think really what we need to look at is the front line of defense, and that is not flooding in the first place. Of course, you know, that's difficult for this catastrophic flood, maybe more than 1,000-year rainfall in some places, but for the thousands and tens of thousands of people with those low levels of floods, we can prevent that.
Well, thank you for joining us today, Carol Friedland from the Louisiana State University Department of Construction Management. We'll be back Monday with a live show on Labor Day. Have a great weekend and stay tuned.